Can I invite you now to lay your hands on a copy of the Bible and we'll turn together to read from the Word of God. And you'll find one of our Bibles sitting underneath the seat that you're sitting on or the seat in front of you. There's a small basket there and the Bibles are contained in there. And to make it easier for you this morning, we're reading from the book of Genesis, which is the very first book of the Bible. So even if you've never opened a Bible before, you should be able to find this. Start at the beginning and around about page 17, you'll find Genesis chapter 18, and it's part of the story of Abraham. Genesis chapter 18, and I'm just going to read to you, or we'll read together, from the beginning of that chapter. It says, as the title, a son is promised to Abraham. Now, just to put you in the picture, Abraham first appears in the book of Genesis in chapter 12, where just out of the blue, God calls him and says, I want you to go to this place and to stay there, and your family will grow there, and this place will be called your own. And it was the beginning of the promised land, the land of Israel, Jerusalem and Galilee, and all these places which feature right throughout the Bible, was the place where the Bible stories happened by and large. And Abraham's family were the people that it all happened to. But these first early chapters of Genesis from chapter 12 onwards describe Abraham and his small family group and what happened to them and their dealings with their neighbors, with one another, and also, of course, with God. And this is one of the stories from Abraham's life. And this is what it says. It says, the Lord appeared to Abraham at the sacred trees of Mamre. As Abraham was sitting at the entrance of his tent during the hottest part of the day, he looked up and saw three men standing there. And as soon as he saw them, he ran out to meet them. And bowing down with his face touching the ground, he said, Sirs, please do not pass by my home without stopping. I am here to serve you. Let me bring some water for you to wash your feet. And you can rest here beneath this tree. And I will also bring a bit of food that will give you strength to continue your journey. You have honored me by coming to my home. So let me serve you. And they replied, Thank you, we accept. And Abraham hurried into the tent and said to Sarah, his wife, Quick, take a sack of your best flour and bake some bread. Then he ran to the herd and picked out a calf that was tender and fat and gave it to a servant who hurried to get it ready. And he took some cream and some milk and the meat and set the food before the men, and there under the tree he served them himself, and they ate. And then they asked him, Where is your wife Sarah? She is there in the tent, he answered. And one of them said, 9 months from now, I will come back and your wife Sarah will have a son. Now Sarah was behind him at the door of the tent, listening. Abraham and Sarah were very old and Sarah had stopped having her monthly periods. So Sarah laughed to herself and said, Now that I am old and worn out, can I still enjoy sex? Or literally, can I still know this pleasure? Probably the pleasure of childbirth or having a child. And besides, my husband is old too. And then the Lord asked Abraham, Why did Sarah laugh and say, Can I really have a child when I am so old? Is anything too hard for the Lord? As I said, 9 months from now I will return, and Sarah will have a son. Because Sarah was afraid, she denied it. I didn't laugh, she said. Yes, you did, he replied. You laughed. Just like that, Betty. You've probably all been there. You know what it's like. You've just sat down, you've put your feet up, you're in front of the fire or in front of the TV, you've got a cup of tea or maybe something stronger. You're ready to do some serious relaxing when, sure as fate, the doorbell rings or the telephone call, and that precious me time is interrupted by family or friends or strangers. Well, that's exactly what happens to Abraham in our Bible reading this morning. In the story, there he was in verse 1, sitting, it says, at the door of his tent, or the entrance to his tent. It's the hottest part of the day, so he's done his morning's work. It's time for his siesta. He's ready to relax. And he looked up and saw three men standing there. Now, I guess he could have just closed his eyes again and pretended to be asleep and hoped that the men would wander on to the next tent down the road, the kind of ancient equivalent of switching on the answering machine. But instead, the story tells us that Abraham leapt up, and the next 8 verses goes on to describe the urgency of his hospitality, the details of the menu that he prepared, the high quality of the food that was served, the urgency of the hospitality, the personal attention which Abraham paid to his guests. So the person who's telling us this story, whoever it was who wrote down Genesis chapter 18 and the rest of this book, is clearly, this was presumably one of Abraham's descendants, is clearly quite proud of what is happening here. He's drawing our attention and say, look at what my great-grandpa did. It's a bit like, you know, if somebody might have today a photo of their great-grandfather shaking hands with Queen Victoria or something like that, and they'd have it in pride of place on the wall to say, look at what they did, look at who was there, look at who they met. But actually, it's more than that, because what our attention is being drawn to is not the person whom Abraham met, who later on turns out not to be just one of three men, but the Lord himself. Maybe notice that it's three men who arrived, but in verse 13, it's the Lord who's speaking to Abraham. But even before Abraham knew who it was, he went to this extravagant trouble and expense to prepare and serve a meal for his strange guests. The passage goes on to tell us about significant things which are just about to be said, about a great promise which is just about to be made, about a huge challenge of faith which is being presented here. But before we get down to any of that, more than half the passage, if you count up the verses, 1 to 8 out of 15, more than half the passage is spent describing the eating and the drinking, the preparing and the serving, before we get down to the business. Or rather, the way the story is told is the vital start of the business before anything else is done. And I think what that does is simply reflects the hospitable nature and character of God. If you go right back to the beginning of Genesis, it describes how when human beings were created, they weren't just dumped in a desert and left to fend for themselves, but they were placed in a garden that had already been prepared for them with every possible comfort. When we come to the Gospels, when that time comes for Jesus to teach his disciples their most vital and urgent lesson, he doesn't sit them down in a lecture theater, but gathers them together in an upper room where they share a meal. And there he promises them that there is a place prepared for them in his Father's house, and that the wine they are drinking together will next be shared together when they enjoy the heavenly banquet which he is inviting them to. So Abraham here is reflecting the nature and the character of God in his generous hospitality, which in a sense is highlighted by what happens to his guests next. If you turn over the page to chapter 19, the next heading is the sinfulness of Sodom. And that's the next stop on the tour of this part of the world that these men were taking. And what happens there is that in the middle of the night they are assaulted, an attempt is made to rob and to rape them. So between chapter 18 and 19 you have a contrast between what happens in the middle of the day and what happened in the middle of the night. between light and darkness, between good and evil, between friendship and hospitality on the one hand, and hostility and exploitation on the other. And the story seems to be told in a way that highlights as right and proper what happens in the passage that we've read today. So it is our Christian privilege to welcome guests, regular church members, visitors from other congregations, and passers-by and people who've never been before. It's our privilege and duty to welcome one another, not just because we need people to come in to give us their money to pay the bills, not just because it's hard work running a church and we need extra volunteers to staff the organizations, not just because some of us are getting on a bit and it would be good to have some younger folks to take our place, but because we value what we have and we long that it can be shared. So when we invite you to stay for tea and coffee after the service, it's not a bribe, okay? In fact, we're smart enough to realize that if we wanted to bribe you, we'd probably need to come up with something better than that. If you're a student today, you're invited to join folks for lunch after the service. And even that, even though you're only a student with no money at all, even that's not a bribe. It's a sharing of who we are and what we have, because we want our people to be able to come together and to share. To say you are welcome, not as a salesman eyeing up customers or a spider wooing the fly into its parlor, but our best attempt in the image of God and his creation and the best traditions of our father Abraham to share the good that we have received. So you are welcome this morning. And even if you choose never to come back again, you'll still have been welcome, and we're glad that you came today. But I wonder what you think it was that Abraham was daydreaming about at the start of our reading. He was sitting at the entrance of his tent during the hottest part of the day. What was going through his mind as he was perhaps nodding off pleasantly to himself? We know when we get to verse 10 that the after-dinner conversation turns to family matters. One of the men, the leader of the group, says to him that 9 months from now I will come back and your wife Sarah will have a son. And that's addressing an issue which has been raised again and again in the story of Abraham and his family as we work our way through this part of the Bible. When we first meet him in chapter 12 in verse 2, God was promising him many descendants. And then again in chapter 15, verse 5, he expands the promise and says, your descendants will be as many as the stars in the sky. And in chapter 17, verse 5, God even went the lengths of changing his name from Abram to Abraham, which means ancestor of many nations. And yet he still had no children. And it wasn't for a want of trying to work out ways around this problem. When he first set out, it was with his nephew Lot, who had family of his own. Perhaps he could carry on the family line, but in chapter 13, Abraham and Lot parted company. In chapter 15, when God elaborated the promise, stars in the sky, Abraham said, well, why don't you use Eliezer, my servant? He's a good guy. He would do the job. And God said, no, it will be one of your sons. And then even in chapter 16, he went and fathered a son by not his wife, but a maidservant, Hagar. But God confirmed in chapter 17, verse 19, not only that it would be a child of Abraham, but a child of his wife, Sarah, as well, through whom the family line would continue. So it might just be that that was what was on his mind, that there he sits outside his tent that sunny afternoon dreaming about what might have been, what ought to be, what he has a reasonable right to expect, but what just hasn't happened. And what he's not able to see happening except in his daydreams, because it just won't work out. And I guess that most of us will have dreamed that kind of dream from time to time, not the greedy dreams that we all sometimes dream about what it would be like to have £1 million to spend, or score the winning goal in the World Cup for Scotland, or sink the winning putt in the Ryder Cup, or perform on stage in front of thousands of fans and flashing lights at the SECC. These are the kind of greedy, selfish dreams, but we also have the simple, humble desires which are a part of us, the desire to have a happy and peaceful family life, perhaps when things aren't quite working out, or to have a satisfying job working for people who appreciate us, perhaps when we're unemployed or under pressure, or to live in a stable and healthy and caring community, perhaps when we don't know the names of any of our neighbours living up the same close, or just to live in a world without war, without disease, without hunger, when we watch what's happening in Syria, South Sudan, Somalia, other parts of the world. Dreams which are not greedy dreams achieved at the cost of exploiting others or boasting and exalting ourselves, but dreams which are simply the natural desires of a healthy human heart that very clearly reflect God's desire for us in the way that he made us, in the way that he made the world. Dreams like Abraham's, perhaps, when all he wanted was a son. And all he had was that frustration of an unfulfilled hope and promise. And he just perhaps couldn't quite understand why that had to be. And then what changes in this story, in the after-dinner conversation, what changes is that God, who has previously promised him a son, now puts a date in Abraham's diary. He doesn't say, just give it time, or it will all work out in the end, or here's hoping. He says, 9 months from now, I will come back and your wife Sarah will have a son. Which means the daydream changes from what would be good to what is going to happen. And I think really that, so far as I can see, is the challenge of Christian faith, that many people would agree with God, as he has described to us in the Bible, about what would be good. We would agree that things should be better, that people should be more loving, that money should be better spent, that weak people should be protected, that wealth should be more fairly distributed. And so we end up with a kind of shared sense of frustration with God that things are not as they should be. But if that's all that it is, then that's not faith in God. It's merely agreement with God. And then we roll up our sleeves and try to make it happen. But faith in God is that confidence which says he is doing it. He is making a difference. A conviction that things are getting better, that is anticipation and not just desire. 9 months from now, Abraham is told, you will have a son. And you don't need a degree in biology to have it explained what the significance of the 9 months is. It is God saying that I have begun. It's already started. You can't see the signs yet. There's no bump in Sarah's tummy yet. There's no dirty nappies, but it's begun. It's happening. 9 months from now, you will see what I have been doing. And I just wonder whether that could be true for some of us as well, that God is not just saying to us, sometime things will get better, but now, starting today. That as human nature longs, sometimes with a passion for things to get better, so God is acting and planting in our hearts a faith which is expecting, a faith which is pregnant, that what is promised by God and hoped for in prayer is actually taking place within us now. That our hearts are being changed so that we will be the blessing to our family and the community builders within our neighborhoods and the changers of the world around about us. Because you see, a pious longing, a daydream in agreement with God, according to which nothing ever actually happens, but it would be good if it did, is actually no use at all. In fact, you'd be better off without it. You'd be better ditching your Christian faith and your Christian faith and saying, this is just what it's going to be like. Let's put up with it and make the most of it. But a faith in a God who comes and meets and is welcomed and who does and returns and shows that what he has said is true, well, that's a faith which is not just good for you. I think it's a faith which no healthy human life could really ever be lived without. Now, I guess there's probably some people here who are thinking, yes, I have longed for those changes, and it's my family or my job or my street or my world that you're talking about there. Yes, I've longed for those changes, but it just isn't going to happen. I've been around for long enough now to know that it just couldn't ever happen to me. And here's a whole list of reasons about my particular situation which makes your promise unattainable. Which is exactly what Sarah said. In verse 12, I'm old and worn out, and it's physically impossible. And there's no denying her doubts. They are perfectly reasonable. She and Abraham have been married for many, many years, and they haven't had a child yet. So why should one suddenly come along now? And notice that in challenging and changing her expectations, God doesn't deny the facts. He doesn't say, no, 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 Sarah, you've got your sums wrong. You're not as old as you think you are. Nor does he try to teach her a lesson in biology, which is different from the one that she knows from long experience. What God does instead is talk about himself. Sarah says, I can't do it because of how old I am and the state I am in. And God says back to her in verse, whereas at verse 14, is anything too hard for the Lord? It's a bit like a jumbo jet sitting on the runway at Glasgow Airport. And on board there are lots of people who are scared of flying. And they really think this great big metal tube will never get up off the ground. And if it does, it will probably crash into the first mountain it tries to cross over. Well, those fears are real and logical when you look at a jumbo jet. It's big, and the idea that it could fly seems ridiculous. But those fears of flight have absolutely no impact on the jumbo jet. It's the physics of flying, the power that comes out of the jet engine and the shape of the wings that means it can fly. And it will fly with them on board, unhampered by their expectations. And the same is true that while Sarah doubts herself on the basis of her experience and all the things that she has done, God's confidence is not in her and therefore not conditional on her, because God's confidence is in himself. Is anything too hard for the Lord? And I think that is always the critical Christian question, not am I a believer? Can I find within my heart the confidence or the courage to believe? Can I take this step in the dark? Dare I? That's not the question. The question is the God in whom I am asked to believe, believable? Are the things that he has said that he is going to do or has done going to happen, or have they happened? Not can I believe it, but is it true? And over the page in chapter 21, verse 1, the Lord blessed Sarah as he had promised, and she became pregnant and bore a son to Abraham when he was old, and the boy was born at the time that God said. You couldn't make this stuff up. It could only be written down and published and believed if it was true. And Abraham, it says, named him Isaac, which in Hebrew means laughter. And no doubt that's because Isaac lay in his cot and giggled, as babies do. It means they're passing wind. And so the name stuck. But it also commemorates God's challenge to Sarah, the words that we're left with quite emphatically at the end of the bit of the story that we read. "Yes, you did," he replied. "You laughed." He's a very rude God in the way that he shames and exposes Sarah, isn't it? Sarah laughs to herself. That's never going to happen. But out of politeness or shame, she kept her face straight and said in verse 15, "I didn't laugh." And maybe there's people here who are doing that, who are pretending to believe, like Sarah when she came out, when in fact we have our doubts. We're saying what people expect us to say, especially when we come here to church. And maybe there's other people who are pretending to be sure, especially outside church, that God means nothing to you, that you don't need him, that you don't want him, that you can carry on utterly independent when in fact you have your doubts. But Sarah's God was not fooled by public declarations. "Yes, you did," he replied. "You laughed." And so the abrupt ending of this passage says to us two things. First of all, that God knows. So there's never, ever any point in pretending, because he knows what you really believe. But second, that God loves. Because the rest of the story is not a punishment of Sarah. "Well, if that's the way you're going to behave, you're not going to get a son after all," but a blessing. A blessing not to shame her unbelief, but to win her in to faith. And as for Abraham, to finish, what did he believe? Well, his reaction is not recorded here, but many hundreds of years later, remembering this story that we've just read, the Apostle Paul said this about him in Romans chapter 4. He said, "His faith did not weaken when he thought of his body, which was already practically dead, or that Sarah could not have children. Abraham believed, and the God who brings the dead to life, and whose command brings into being what did not exist." And what Paul was thinking about when he wrote those words was not just the ancient story of Abraham and Sarah and their miracle child, new life from their elderly barren bodies, but the risen life of God's crucified Son. The real proof with power that the one who has promised has already come and begun. And the power to change, the power to transform, the power to revitalize is actively forcing its way out through those who believe in him into the world. So are those dreams that you have too good to be true? Or could it be that your life-giving God has already come and begun to deliver? And if that is the case, are you mocking behind his back? Or lying to his face? Or living in faithful anticipation? We're going to stand together and sing this hymn, which reflects on the hope that as Christians we have in our risen Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ.